Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Luther, how are you?
Yeah, how are you?
Good, good. Welcome. Let me just really get started real quickly. I was a little behind. Tonight we're having economic expert Dr. Michael Butler, PhD, professor of finance at Stockton University in New Jersey. Looking forward to it. He'll be coming on very quickly. I want to touch on this whole situation with Kavanaugh. Did you see the mockery? The whole, it was disgraceful how these politicians from the left, basically with their cronies, did what they did today and yesterday with Kavanaugh. I mean, it's become, we're becoming a third world country here.
Unbelievable.
It is. It is. It's totally. It's out of control. Something has to happen because the nomination process that we currently have totally is disgraceful. How do we pretend to be a first world country with, when we have politicians like this behaving and having, I mean, totally embarrassing. I mean, the whole world is watching this. And these opposition, the opposition party really is embarrassing all of us.
Well, they,
I can't hear you.
You can't let the liberals win Obama because if they get the majority, they'll overturn everything that's screwed up. You know, that's right. We don't see what happens if people are going to be won. Who does it for spies? They're just going to get the hospital every day.
Right. Well, yes. It's definitely, I'm just so disgusted. So upset with what the little chance that I got to view some of the things that have happened today. I didn't get a chance to witness the whole circus yesterday, and I'm glad I did. I'm glad that I didn't miss much. Okay, but the fact that you disagree with someone, okay, that's fine. But to make a mockery of the whole nominee procedure is totally, should not be tolerated at all. So I just, but let's focus on the positive things, which is basically the economy is booming, and we have a good, we're going in the right direction as a country. I believe that I keep seeing a lot of signs to hire people, openings, you know. So I think there's a new spirit. The American spirit has been reborn.
People need to understand that
Luther, hang up and call again because I'm not hearing you that well.
Okay, I'll call again.
All right, my co-host will be coming back right now. It's having some issues on the line, on his line, and he'll be coming back. I'm looking forward to speaking to Professor Butler now, who should be coming on the line right now.
Hello.
Good evening, Professor. How are you, Professor Butler?
I'm doing very well.
All right. Well, just waiting for my co-host to come back on the line, and I'm glad that you were able to come on tonight to broadcast in politics.
Really?
We have a lot of great news to share, right, in regards to the economy?
Yeah, absolutely. Some really great news.
Fantastic. Can you just basically give I briefly touched on your name and
that
you were an economic expert, but if you can go on beyond that point.
Okay, so I'm an economist and a public policy analyst. I write for Town Hall, LifeZet, and Newsmax.
Right.
And mostly on economics issues and other public policy issues. I'm a professor of finance. I'm a professor of finance at Stockton University in New Jersey.
I'm from New Jersey, so we're
You're from New Jersey?
Yes. Good old Millburn, New Jersey.
Millburn, is that up north?
That's in Essex County.
Essex, okay. I'm in Southfield, just down beach from Atlantic City. Yeah.
I'm very familiar with your university and Stockton University.
Excellent.
Yes. But so I want to touch on something because I have a lot of family and friends in New Jersey. Before we go on to the global, domestic, national economic, where is New Jersey? Because New Jersey has a special heart in my special place in my heart.
Please. Yeah.
Where is New Jersey going now that we officially have a sanctuary governor like Phil Murphy?
Yeah. Well, I think we're heading in the wrong direction. You know, we're trying to grow the state, attract more people here, and what he's doing is exactly the opposite. We're overtaxed. We have the second highest property taxes in the country. We have a 7% sales tax. We have a state income tax, could be as high as he just raised it up to 11%. On October 1st, the gas tax goes up by a little over 4 cents a gallon. And he's adding a bunch of regulations that are likely to drive businesses out of the state. One, he wants the minimum wage to go up to $15 an hour. That'll drive businesses out of the state. And I don't know how I live on a resort town. I don't know how the shore seasonal businesses can survive with a $15 an hour minimum wage. It simply doesn't work.
Well,
so I'm a little bit nervous.
They'll pass it on to the consumer. That's basically
that's what you hope. You know, that's what he hopes. There's probably a limit to how much the consumer will take.
Right. Right.
That's the issue.
That was one of the reasons I left.
Property taxes, my wife keeps saying to me, with all these taxes, she doesn't know why we stay here. I tell her because I love the Jersey Beach too much.
Oh, I'm right behind you, Professor. I mean, Bradley Beach.
Bradley Beach is nice. I live just down beach from Atlantic City.
Yeah.
So
I would spend my summers on the shore. I mean, Cape May.
You can't beat the Jersey Shore in the summer. I don't think anywhere in the world can beat the Jersey Shore in the summer.
No, it's like I said, New Jersey has a special place in my heart and I go back quite often.
Excellent.
Okay, great. So now we're basically looking at the domestic national economy.
Okay.
We keep hearing about the highest GDP in a long time. Unemployment at 4.3, 16-year low. Earnings
actually it's better than that. It's down under 4%. It's now almost a 50-year low.
Okay. So but basically, stronger job growth, record
absolutely.
High stock. Housing market is booming. So trade deficits are down. So why are we hearing so much complaints and criticism from everyone that feels that they're economic experts like you?
The criticism, it can't be aimed toward the economy. The criticism is all aimed toward Donald Trump. Those that criticize, even the most knowledgeable economists, like Paul Krugman, who writes the Nobel Prize mm-hmm. winner, writes for the New York Times, he just is way off with what he says. Look, the facts are that the economy has not had 3% annual growth since 2005. We haven't had 4% annual growth since the year 2000. That's the longest period of economic stagnation in history. The reason is the prior administration never put economic growth as a priority. The prior administration, their economic priorities were to cure perceived social injustices. Like it's an injustice that everybody doesn't have health care. It's an injustice that big business takes advantage of consumers. It's an injustice that wealthy people make hundreds of times more than the average person. So his policies were geared to cure those social injustices, and every one of the cures slowed economic growth. For instance, he passed the Affordable Care Act to provide health insurance to all Americans. It helped about 6% of the population, since the insured went from 85% of the population up to 91%. So it helped about 6% of the population. Meanwhile, it had 23 either new taxes or raised taxes. That reduces the spendable income for the middle class, tends to slow economic growth. The Affordable Care Act also said that every employer had to pay for health insurance for every employee or pay a $3,000 fine. That added to the cost of labor, made expansion more expensive, slowed economic growth. With the Affordable Care Act, it tried to reach the social goals, although it didn't, that he wanted, but it ended up slowing economic growth. He also felt that banks were taking advantage of consumers. So he gets the Dodd-Frank bill passed mm-hmm. to stop what he called predatory lending, where banks lent to people who President Obama said they shouldn't have lent to because the people really couldn't afford the mortgages. So he passes the Dodd-Frank bill, which essentially eliminates all that, quote, predatory lending. However, it also reduced all business lending. When you reduce lending, the monetary policy doesn't work. It only works when the banks are lending money and you get a multiplying effect. So by reducing the lending through Dodd-Frank, you reduce the multiplying effect of monetary policy, again, tended to slow economic growth. Bush passes a tax cut in 2001, expires in 2011. President Obama made the tax cuts permanent for everybody except the highest income earners. Their right. income taxes went up by 10%. What that did was it reduced the amount of investment capital that the wealthy had. That meant there was less capital going into the economy. We have a capital-intensive economy. You put less capital in, tends to slow economic growth. He put in hundreds, really thousands of regulations designed to protect consumers and cure any perceived social injustices. That, too, adds to the cost of expansion, adds to the cost of business, slows economic growth. So everything the prior administration did to solve these social issues slowed economic growth. So what happens? President Trump gets into office. Right after he's sworn in the next month or two, he starts getting rid of all these regulations that have been holding us back. Since he's done that, the economy has grown at about a 3% rate. Then in last November, he convinced Congress to cut taxes for all Americans, middle class and the upper class. What that did was the middle class had more to spend. Stimulated spending tends to add to growth. The upper class had more capital to invest in a capital-intensive economy. That tends to add to growth. The tax cut goes into effect last January. By April of this year, The economy is growing at a 4% annual rate. In the current quarter, the third quarter, the estimate, first estimate will be out the end of October. I think the economy is growing at a 4.5% rate.
Hmm.
And it's, I wouldn't be surprised if next year we saw a quarter or two where economic growth exceeded 5%. Now, as far-fetched as that might sound, I would remind you, President Trump modeled his tax cut after what Reagan did in 81. Reagan's
right.
tax cut went into effect in 1982. In 1984, for the entire year, the economy grew at a 7.5% rate. So I think we're in for some good growth ahead. I'm very optimistic about the economy. And except for the fact that they don't like Trump and they just want to get him out of office and make him look as bad as they can, the New York Times published an op-ed today that said how hectic things are in the Trump White House. However, they wouldn't put the name of the person who wrote it because he said he has to remain anonymous. They're just out to get President Trump. And if they looked at it objectively, they would reach the same conclusions I do.
Professor, that's the reason they have a very important name in front of the New York Times building on 43rd Street in New York City. It's called fake news. Fake news.
They're publishing it because they just want Trump out of there. They can't believe they lost the election. The day after he gets sworn in, they start screaming impeach him, and they've been trying to get him out of office now for a year and a half. In spite of that, he has accomplished some marvelous things.
Right. Well, if you don't mind, I like to add something else that I think is important.
Sure. Sure.
The addition of money that has been brought back by multinational companies, U.S. multinational companies that have brought back money and are investing it here in the United States, plus multinational companies from other parts of the world that feel confident that they have a real businessman here running the country, and they have actually
invested
their
here.
Investments here. Would you agree?
Absolutely. The corporate tax rate on average was about 35%. So large corporations said, look, we can't pay that. So Apple buys a little tiny house over in Ireland, calls that its corporate headquarters. They now pay a much lower corporate tax rate. So they were headquartered there. General Electric has a little house, I think, in Switzerland or Sweden. They call their headquarters, so they pay their taxes. Again, nothing comes to the U.S. Well, President Trump lowered the corporate tax rate to 21%. Now it's as low or lower than most countries. So companies say, hey, there's no reason not to be in the U.S. They're pro-business now. In addition to that, all the money that companies like Apple and GE had made over the years, to bring it back into the U.S., they would get charged a huge penalty. President Trump reduced the penalty down to, I think, 10%. So now they're bringing all that money back into the country, and just as you said, they're investing. And even companies like BMW say, hey, there's a lower tax rate in the U.S. They're business friendly. I'm building a new plant in South Carolina. So you're right.
Exactly.
It's attracting foreign investment here too.
That's another reason the stock market is booming too, because a lot of the institutional investment is one, but also the foreign investment. I mean, you have an European Union that is totally divided and on the verge, in my opinion. And I was just in Holland in Europe in June.
Yeah.
And
there's
a lot of fear.
Dissent.
Because
a lot of dissent there.
A lot of dissent in the situation in England with the Brexit, it's totally has divided the European Union. So a lot of those companies, I believe, and even individual investors are seeing the U.S. as the only option around the globe that they can actually make some money, correct?
Yes. Yeah. And the U.S. now, as you said, with Trump in the lead here in control, you have a business-friendly environment. All of Europe is going the way President Obama went during his administration. They're more concerned with curing perceived social injustices than they are with getting their economy moving. And frankly, even if they want to cure the social injustices, it's much easier to do that if your economy is real strong and everybody has plenty of money. They try to do it from a position of weakness, and they're running into trouble.
Well, I think, it boils down to that mentality that government can do everything and can control everything. And I think that's the mentality of the opposition. All the good news that we're hearing, Professor.
Yes.
But I do have a question for you, and I've always had this question, and you're an economic expert on this. If the economy is booming and everything looks beautiful, why are the wage growth always, and it's been like that for a long time, wages don't grow at the same pace as the economy? Why is that?
Yeah, so I'm not exactly sure what that means. So do you mean that they said wages haven't grown in 20 years? So does that mean people are making the same amount of money that they were 20 years ago? No, that's not right. And incomes are going way up. What they mean by that, if somebody was an entry-level, let's say, electrician, and 20 years ago, the entry-level electrician started at $15 an hour. Well, now he's only at $22 an hour. So if you adjust for inflation, he should be a little higher than he is. And that's probably true. But the reality is people don't stay at entry-level positions. They end up moving up. They get promoted. They get more experience. They get another job. So to say wages are stagnant, you're right. If somebody started an entry-level job and he stayed there for the next 20 years, his wage would be stagnant. But the reality is people move up and they get better pay. If you look at personal income, which accounts for everything, not just the wage somebody was earning, but if they get new jobs, their income goes up. That's a better measure. Plus, people earn income from other ways also. But if you take a look at personal incomes, they're going up 4 or 5% a year and have been for the last few years. Even during the weak economy of Obama, they were going up 2-3% a year. So to say the wages haven't there's no wage growth, and it makes it sound very negative, like people are still making the same amount of money. You know, the reality is people are doing much better today, and even with the stagnant economy, they still did okay during the stagnant economy, and now they're about to do much, much better. You know, it's not so much the wage growth number, but I take a look at my students who graduated. For the last 10 years, they're lucky to get one good job offer. Many times, they had to take a job for which they were overqualified. You didn't need the college degree. So they get a lot of what we call underemployment. As a result of that, the jobs for people that don't have college degrees, they're not available to those people. So the people without the degrees drop out of the labor market. You get discouraged workers, probably 5 or 6 million of those nationwide. So that's that was really more of the problem during the Obama administration. People start saying, I don't need a college degree. I could have got this job without the college degree. And they're right, because without the growth in the economy, you're not providing new jobs for the college graduates. This year, people are going out, will go out in May and June and to work. They'll have a good job offer. Many of them will see multiple job offers the way it used to be years ago. And you see a lot of the underemployed college graduates from the last 10 years, they're starting to find jobs where they can take advantage of their degree. As a result, a lot of these discouraged workers, in the month of June, I think there were 600,000 discouraged workers came back into the workforce. That's going to add to the labor force. That, too, is going to help stimulate growth. I'm very optimistic about growth, and the fact that wages are stagnant is a misleading way to look at things, really people are doing better and they're going to start to do much better.
I agree. My co-host, Luther, do you have a question for Professor Butler?
Yeah, I have a question. They're all wanting Trump out, and he's making jobs. And these people are wanting Trump out. What are they trying to do? Well, in my opinion, anybody who wants to run a president out of office that's making jobs is trying to make this country go bankrupt.
Yeah. Look, they just don't like Trump. They don't like the fact that he won the election. They don't like the fact that he's a New Yorker from Queens and he's a business person. They just want him out. You know, they don't understand his personality. They don't understand his direct approach. They don't understand the tweets that he does. You know, and to all those people, I just tell them, go walk around the streets of Queens in New York for an hour or so. Talk to the people. They're all like that. That really everything, they're very proud people. They think everything they have is the biggest and the best. I mean, that's just the way the people are up there. So Trump has a similar kind of personality. That's it. We're not used to it. It's different. You're right, but it's the way he is.
Definitely.
What did they do before Trump got in? Any of them? What did any of them do? They weren't making jobs, but now that Trump's in making jobs, they're going to go after Trump? So that just tells me that jobs are about bankrupting this country and stopping him from saving this republic, in my opinion.
Exactly. Now, another thing that Obama did that Trump will start dealing with starting next year is the fact that we had huge deficits. The public debt, the total of all deficits when Obama got into office was about $11 trillion. He left office, it was $19 trillion. So he almost doubled the amount of debt. Now, Trump is running a deficit for a couple reasons. One, he cut taxes, although tax revenue was actually higher the first 6 months of this year than it was last year. The rates went down, but activity picked up. So we're actually bringing in more money. So he agreed last September to a big spending bill. And when he signed the bill, he said, "Never again will I sign a bill like this." So he allowed the spending to increase. He also recognized the military has been decimated, mostly by the prior administration, who convinced Congress to pass the sequester, which said for every dollar in social programs you want to cut, you have to cut a dollar out of the military, which decimated the military. So Trump said we have to spend money to fix that. So for the next 2 years, he's got this year and next year, he's got a lot of money in there for that. So the deficit will be a little larger than he'd like. Starting next year, though, he's going to start tackling government spending in areas where people politically couldn't touch it. He has the will and the guts to go ahead. And again, he's not a politician. He's a business person. So a business person sees a big problem because it's affecting your bottom line. You have to attack it right away. That's his personality. He's going to start attacking the spending. He'll get the deficit down, not by raising taxes, which would slow economic growth, but rather by reducing spending to where it should be, rather than where all these special interests and special programs have the numbers.
Well, that's going to be, Professor, that's going to be a real challenge for President Trump, because Washington, D.C. is full of special interest groups.
Absolutely.
And that's going to create a real, real tug of war between.
I agree with you completely. It's going to create what seems like an insurmountable mountain. The only person in history who would even try it is Donald Trump.
Right.
And everybody vote red.
Yeah.
But anyway, what's the difference, in your opinion, between the previous Fed chairman, Janet Yellen, and the new Fed chairman, Jerome Powell? Is there a difference, a huge difference, or basically the Fed chairman follows the same policy, which is basically curbing inflation, maintaining job growth?
Yes. Okay, so Janet Yellen, although philosophically probably a little different than President, a lot different than President Trump, but she followed a very sound monetary policy. She was about to do some things, I think, that may have caused some issues. So I think replacing her at that time Trump did was a good idea. But so the Federal Reserve massively increased the money supply massively to get out of the recession, and they dropped interest rates virtually to zero. The economy should have boomed. Because Obama passes the Dodd-Frank and the monetary policy becomes ineffective, it doesn't boom. But the economy staggered along for all these years. Now, when it looked like the economy was starting to be stable again, it's time to bring the interest rates up. So Janet Yellen brought them up a little bit. Powell, too, now that the economy is much stronger. See, you don't want the economy to overheat. You want it to grow as much as possible, but you want to be able to sustain the growth without causing inflation. Abnormally low interest rates, where we still are today, will tend to cause inflation in the economy, especially if it's revving up the way it is. So I think Powell is doing exactly the right thing. I think the Federal Reserve is doing exactly the right things. They're gradually taking the interest rates up. They should end up being, with the kind of growth we're going to have for the next couple of years, they should be at or even slightly above historical averages. So I think he's taking it up slowly enough that it won't hurt growth, but enough that he'll keep any inflation out. The 10-year Treasury historically has been in the 3-3.5% range. It's still under 3%. The housing market is always good when mortgages are 6% or less. They're still under 5%. So there's still room to take the interest rates up to keep the economy from overheating without causing any negative impacts on growth. And I think Powell is doing it the right way.
So for our listening audience, now that they've heard quite a few economic terms, what's the difference between inflationary economy and a deflationary economy?
Okay, so inflation and deflation, very simple definition. Inflation just means prices are going up.
Okay.
Deflation means prices are going down. The Federal Reserve tries to keep prices stable. That is the best thing for us. Now, they call stable prices, if inflation is less than 2% or they used to go as high as 3, but if the inflation stays relatively low, so prices are only going up, 1, 2, 3% a year, that's fine. You don't want them to go up too fast. It ends up getting an inflation psychology where people say, look, the price is going up. I better hurry up and buy it before it goes up again. And because everybody says, I want to go hurry up and buy it, the price ends up going up again. So you get this inflation cycle. Look at Venezuela. They've really got this psychology. So
we are going to touch on those countries in a little while. I have it on my agenda here.
Mm-hmm. Good. So you don't want inflation to get too high. You want it to stay under 3%, really under about 2%. It's right in that range now. They gradually take the interest rates up. We're still getting the growth we're looking for, and the inflation is staying relatively low. Deflation, we were worried about after the financial crisis. Now, deflation means falling prices. So in the housing market, for instance, and many markets in particular, you ended up having a big deflation in home values.
Right. So a scenario like Japan that has been in a deflationary mode since the 1980s and an inflationary mode like we had in the late 70s under Jimmy Carter, it's not something that you see in the near future.
No, we learned after the Jimmy Carter experience, the Federal Reserve learned what to do to make sure that never happens again. And that is control the interest rates and the money supply. It's really the money supply you're controlling. They know how to control that so that high inflation is very unlikely to ever happen again.
Got it. Since you brought it up just now, we're looking at current situations like in Venezuela, where individuals, groups voted for socialism,
right?
Equal justice, social justice. We have countries like also like Nicaragua, Argentina now, and countries around the world that are basically decided to go in that direction. And now today they're paying for it. Why is there such a push for socialism now in our country when the economy is booming and it's shown that capitalism is the way to go?
What happened, because we had such a slow growth economy, really, it's been 12 years since we had a 3% annual growth rate. 2005 was the last time. So since we've had that, you get, as I said, a lot of workers got forced out of the market. A lot of people got put on food stamps. We're paying more in food stamps than we ever did. The prior administration took the work requirement off of welfare and increased the amount of welfare spending. So now there's more welfare spending. So people become dependent, and then he gave them free health care, everybody free health care. So if with free health care, food stamps, and welfare payments, people become very dependent. The economy doesn't have much opportunity because it's not growing. So these people become dependent. And then people with a conscience start to say, all these dependent people really don't have much. Don't you have a big compassionate heart? Just look, these guys have so much. Take some of what they earned and give it to people who didn't earn it, because you feel that they should have something. It ends up causing severe problems. You know, Margaret Thatcher said, socialism works until you run out of somebody else's money. Venezuela just ran out of somebody else's money.
Yeah.
And that's why they're in this crisis.
One of the best quotes I've ever heard, Margaret Thatcher's about socialism.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, well.
Yep, and that's what happens in Venezuela today. They're out of the other people's money. And now the business isn't making anything. There's no capital to do anything. Their currency is worthless. People want whatever they can get, and there's nothing available, so you get prices going up outrageously. And that's what socialism leads to. It starts out – now, people argue back about some of the democratic socialism that they have in Sweden and Norway and Denmark and some of those countries. They say, well, look, that socialism works over there, they would argue. And that's what they think you should head towards.
I came back from Holland, and they tax you around 50 to 55% of your salary.
62% in Amsterdam. 62% on average.
Yeah. So basically, they do look at the nice things. The roads are really nice, and everything is really nice. But basically, the government really has control over your money. That's the bottom
absolutely.
Line. Yeah.
Yeah. But, and once they get control over the money, they get control over other things. For instance, Elizabeth Warren says colleges should be free, tuition free. Let everybody go to college for free. Well, of course, it's not free. They just mean that the students don't have to pay for it. They want the taxpayers to end up paying for it. The problem is then the government is in control of the education system. So suppose the government says, you know, we have a glut of lawyers now, so I'm going to shut down some of the law schools and stop some people from becoming lawyers. The way it is now, we probably do have a glut of lawyers, but if somebody wants to become a lawyer, there's a glut of lawyers, you still have the right to do that. So you can still do that. If the government controls the education system, they're going to start limiting and start determining what fields are open and who should go into what field. And pretty soon you have an extremely inefficient system that will eventually lead to collapse. The more freedom and capitalism you put into the system, the more growth you're going to get. And in my opinion, the fair distribution of income.
Well, this part of our interview is going to do with the future of individuals that are studying at universities like your, like Stockton University in New Jersey.
Yep. Yep.
In regards to finance, based on your experience, based on your experience being the instructor, the professor, what's the current attitude towards the different models of economy, the Freeman model or the more progressive model, which I forgot his name because I don't really think about him. Milton Freeman is more my more in line with
my mine too. Mine too. The other one was, I guess, developed originally by John, the Keynesian school, by John John Keynes, they would say. There was a few other ones that come along that added to that progressive school. Currently have Paul Krugman, who writes for the New York Times, Robert Reich, who used to be Secretary of Labor. He does a lot, too. So those people are more for the progressive. They think things should be shared more equally. past laws like the CEO can't earn so many times more than the lowest paid worker. Elizabeth Warren introduced the bill, the ACA, I forget exactly what it stands for. It's not the Affordable Care Act, but something about changing capitalism. But the gist of the law says any corporation with over $1 billion in sales, rather than get a charter from the state, they have to get a charter from the government. And the government charter will require that corporations, when making decisions, especially major decisions, consider the impact not just on their stockholders, but on their employees, on the surrounding customer, surrounding community, and their customers. And those decisions will have to be approved by the government, at least the major decisions. There is another instance of her wanting the government to get involved and control corporations to get what she will feel will be a more socially just outcome. The reality is it will end up with the company making less profit, less innovation, and you end up with a very inefficient company because it's doing what the government wants rather than what the marketplace wants, as Milton Friedman would advocate.
I got a question.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The ones that are trying to stop Trump, wouldn't you agree they're trying to fade out the middle class?
They're trying to do what?
Fade out the middle class.
Offer no class? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
What is the people that are against Trump and trying to run Trump out of office, they're attempting to stop him. And their attempt is to fade out the middle class. And if we lose,
exactly,
we don't vote and get Trump some help, that this is all around. And in my opinion, they're trying to fade out the middle class. They're working against him. He's making jobs. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, and in fact, they're going to say exactly the opposite. They say we're going to protect the middle class.
They're trying to do even worse than that. Trying to phase out the middle class. My name is Joe. I'll wait.
Yeah, Joe. I was just about. Joe, do you have a question for Professor Bessler?
Oh, one question. Okay. Are you? I presume you're not exactly pro-Fed. Are you pro-Fed or more or less anti-Fed?
The Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of debate on that. I still think there's a usable function for the Federal Reserve, particularly in watching that the economy doesn't hit any catastrophic areas. Like in the late 70s was pointed out, we had a stagflation problem, high inflation and a stagnant economy.
Which Volcker supposedly fixed. Okay.
Yeah. And we also had a deep recession in 08, 09 that the Federal Reserve was able to, in spite of the administration seemingly to fight against it, the Federal Reserve was still able to, I believe, pull us out of that. And when it comes to extreme positions, I think the Federal Reserve does have a function, although I understand the other side of the argument, too, that really they have they're doing a little too much and they exercise too much control.
I'd like to wait until the other call is finished, and then I'd like to give my two cents on the other side of the Fed.
All right. Go ahead. It's your time now.
Who, me or the other one?
No, you.
Me, okay.
Yeah.
The Fed was founded in 1913. There was a Senator McFadden who was against it, and it for good reason. Number one, there is no economically viable reason whatsoever why our currency has to be based upon debt, when all you have to do with the money that's being printed to form the bonds, which keeps us in debt, if you eliminate the bond factor, just let the Treasury print the money, you have zero dime, zero penny of debt. So I don't understand how anybody can say the Fed has a usefulness.
Well, wait a minute. Say that again. You want the Treasury to print all the money and we won't have any debt then?
Exactly.
So in other words, if the government spends more money than it takes in revenue, you just want the Treasury to print enough money to cover that. So there's no debt.
I just want no debt. Even if the Treasury prints $1 trillion more than it takes in, it still has no debt because it's not issuing bonds.
Yeah, you would also have about a 500% inflation rate.
We have that already, ever since 19.
No, we don't. Inflation's about 2%.
It is not. Inflation is, even if you go to the website of I forget the name of the government website. It's way
Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Yeah. The
BLS.
Labor Statistics. So if you take a look at the prices of 1913 to the prices of food, which is not even accounted in CPI, you realize we have a lot more than 10% a year. It's over 500%.
Well,
so there is no usefulness for the
Are you saying prices go up five times in a year? So something costs $3 in the beginning of the year is 15 at the end?
You didn't say Venezuelan inflation. You said 500%, which means to me the total of 500%. No, it's not. It'll never go 500% if you give it to the Treasury.
Unless you print money recklessly like that, that will lead to runaway inflation.
You know what that argument is? You can use that same argument with the Fed. If you don't have 500% inflation now with the Fed increasing money
because they control the money supply.
And
the Federal Reserve controls the money supply.
So you're saying the Treasury would have far less control than the Fed?
They would have no control. They would just print enough money to cover the amount of government spending. They'd have no control over it. If you don't want any debt, they're just printing money.
Professor,
right.
debt is an accounting of issuing loans. If you have no bonds, you have no loans to pay back.
Right.
Well,
so there is no debt.
Let me interject in there. I know you have totally two different opposite views on this. But I think one of the questions that I have for you, Professor Bessler, is why do they exclude from the CPI? Why do they exclude food and oil?
They don't exclude those. The CPI is made up of 100 products the average consumer is most likely to buy. It's taken in 53 cities around the country, and each month they go back to the exact same places to buy the same stuff, and they see how much prices have gone up. It includes food, housing, transportation, and most other goods that consumers would likely buy routinely.
Yeah, if it's including food, it's including it on a 1% weighted basis. So the CPI is a useless one if it includes food. Also, when you have...
Well, there is a GDP deflator that takes food and housing costs, food and energy costs, rather, out of it. So you can look up the GDP deflator, but that also is running under 3%.
And also in the GDP equation, the more the government spends, then the equation seems to have on the other side of it, that the GDP, the economy, is doing well, which is a false
If that's true, hang on a second. If that's true, why didn't, when Obama increased spending tremendously, why didn't the economy grow?
Because he's spending.
And I'll tell you the answer. Let me give you the answer. The reason is you just can't spend money and expect the economy to grow. He spent money in areas where the market didn't want it. So as a result, there was very little multiplying effect. He bought solar panels, whatever he did with the conservation programs, which did nothing. It got him his social justice, but it had no multiplying effect.
That's because
solar panel companies
money.
Went out of business.
It's because you're spending government money, which means it has to be taken out of taxes. The economy doesn't grow when you're spending in one hand and you're taking the money from the consumer on the other.
They didn't. He ran up a $1.4 trillion deficit in his second year in office. So they didn't take the money out. They borrowed it to finance it, unlike just printing it up. They borrowed it, which ended up taking capital out of the economy for expansion, which slowed economic growth.
That's right.
But you just said the government can spend money and get a lot of growth. I said, no, you can't do that.
I'm saying the Treasury, if you eliminate the Fed and you eliminate the debt premise, then the Treasury can spend money and the economy.
You can't you can't just print money. That's what leads to inflation. When the Federal Reserve...
We're not going to get
money in and of itself.
We're not going to get anything different. Let's move on.
Okay.
Let's move on.
Right.
I wanted to touch on the thank you, Joe, on that. I wanted to touch on the whole situation with what the mentality of your students, your finance students. Are they more pro-capitalist, model, or are they diverting themselves into other models, the socialist model?
That happens to be a great question, because the university where I teach was originally founded as a liberal arts college. With the exception of the School of Business, which is the largest school, everybody else there has a very liberal view on things. So the business students understand capitalism and favored the free enterprise system. The rest of the school thinks Bernie Sanders is the greatest, and they want to follow everything he does.
Okay, so there is some
that's
hope.
Where they are.
There is some hope that because the way I'm hearing, the college students now today are more focused, especially the millennials, are more diverting their attention to the socialist model instead of the capitalist model.
Yeah, recent studies show that millennials favor socialism over capitalism, which is very disturbing.
That's exactly why I brought that up, because you are a professor at a public university in New Jersey and in a very liberal state. And I wanted to get a feedback on where are we heading? Are we basically your finance students who will be working somewhere in the financial business, financial environment? What is the mental way of looking at
it? Well, the people in the business fields understand the concept of business. They don't go for the socialism at all. They typically earn more income and they want to keep what they earned. So they don't go for the socialism model. In many of the other fields, people are looking more toward that socialism model. I think what is these next election in November is very critical. If the Republicans, and I think the Republicans are going to maintain control in the House, and I think they're going to increase the number of senators. But if I'm wrong, and the Democrats end up winning one House of Congress, and they start to thwart President Trump's agenda, and or if you get people like Cory Booker from New Jersey or Kamala Harris from California, if you get some of those people putting their ideas through, Elizabeth Warren, I think we run into trouble. You know, I recall back in 1972 when George McGovern offered these very same socialistic ideas, he got clobbered in the presidential election. Now, I know times are a lot different. We just lived through 8 years of President Obama, so I'm a little bit nervous. But, and with the press, you know, President Trump's got every Democrat voting no on everything he says. He's got the press, which has three different studies, say they over 90% of the coverage is negative. And he's got people in his own party that don't like him. And in spite of that, he's able to get things done. So if he can keep going with his agenda, and as Americans start to remember what prosperity feels like Americans have forgotten what prosperity feels like, because it's really been since the year 2000 we had 4% growth. That's what prosperity feels like. Once we start to remember what that prosperity feels like, I think people are going to tend more toward the free market capitalistic model. They're going to see that, hey, we tried this under Obama. It didn't work. Look, we may think Trump is a bad person, and they do, but he's a good president because what he's putting into effect is working for us. You know, bad people can be good presidents. Bill Clinton's a perfect example of that. He was really a bad person, and he turned out to be a good president. You know, he's the one, he cut the capital gains tax from 28 to 20%. His exact words were, in his State of the Union speech, I believe in 97, the era of big government is over, is what he said. He managed to run a surplus in the budget, working with Newt Gingrich in the House.
Right.
And he had 4.5% growth for 4 years after the capital gain cut. Though that's what prosperity feels like. Everybody was feeling good. People were making money. There were jobs available for everybody. You didn't like your job. You weren't afraid to leave it. You know you could find a better one. People were not so angry at each other like they are today. So I think if Trump can keep going and get that prosperity returned, a lot of this talk of socialism will go away.
Well, let me say, Professor, you're not going to be wrong, because I predicted on this show that we are going to win. They're going to win in November, and they're going to retain both the House and the Senate. I'll give you a very short, brief description why. First of all, the Democratic Party is divided. You have the Socialist Democrats, and then you have the establishment Democrats, and there's a division right there. That's not going to work well with them come November.
Yeah.
So
I don't think so either. The only thing they have going for them, they don't put a whole lot of policy proposals that would be accepted by the majority of Americans. So the only thing they have to run on is not Trump. So they just try to make Trump look as bad as possible, coming up with every possible thing they can come up with and find, and miraculously he's been able to fight all these things off. I mean, there's a special investigator. He's not concerned about what's happened with Russia. He just wants to pull Trump down.
Of course.
And Trump's been able to fight that. They get anybody that worked for Trump that has a parking ticket from anywhere, they indict them and try to get them to flip on Trump, and they're starting to realize there's nothing to flip. He didn't do anything wrong. But
that's
in spite of all this he has to fight, he's still able to get this done. I think it's a remarkable achievement what he's been able to do.
It is. Before we leave, because this has been enjoyable, I'd like for you to come back again.
Sure.
What if you can give me, do you have a website, a blog?
Yeah.
Newsmax?
Sure. So I have a page on Facebook. It's called Funding Democracy, the Economics of Freedom. So to get to it, just facebook.com/ Funding Democracy, Funding Democracy. Just you can go to on your own Facebook, just put in the search bar Funding Democracy, and you'll see it. My last 300 or 400 columns from 4 or 5 years are there.
All right. Well, thank you again for coming, taking time to come. And again, let's preserve and keep New Jersey beautiful.
Thank you. I appreciate being here. And tell Joe I appreciate the lively discussion.
That's right.
All right. Have a good evening and a great week. All right, Luther, you want to say something?
Yeah.
Are you there?
All right. Yes. Luther, you want to say something too? Before we get off?
Well, yeah.
Hurry up.
When was the last time a president had an economy growing that he lost Congress and the Senate? I don't see I think the liberals are grasping for straws because the economy's growing. Every day they got people. The people are learning more and more what they're up to.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. We're off the air. Thank you,
we're
Professor. Thank you, Luther.
All right. Thank you.
Evening.
A pleasure.
Okay.
God bless
all right.
You.
Thank you.